Welcome to Behind the News. My name is Doug Henwood, and we're looking, as we do most weeks at this time, at the worlds of economics and politics. Two guests up today, as usual. First, in a few minutes, we'll hear from Lukas Zeise, who is a columnist for the Financial Times Deutschland, the German edition of the paper, on why Germany is being so austere in its approach to the European crisis and what the future holds for the euro. Hint, nothing good. And then, a bit before the bottom of the hour, we'll speak with Jody Dean, author of Blog Theory, on the unwillingness of the left, such as it is, and what digital culture is doing to us. Before all that, some words in the news, and only a few words, because today's serving of interviews is rather generous. First, the U.S. economy does look to be picking up some speed, at least in the consumption side. It was reported earlier this week that retail sales rose a strong 0.8% between October and November, or 1.2% if you leave out autos. Both numbers were quite strong, about twice their historical average, and came after a strong performance in October as well. The year-to-year growth rate, which, as they say, is a rather easy comparison since last fall was pretty depressed, is now approaching 8%, also about twice its historical average. These numbers aren't adjusted for inflation, and since inflation is much lower now than it was in the past, the figures are even stronger than they seem on first glance. This retail strength is a mixed bag. While it's good to see signs of recovery from the slump, it looks like a lot of bad habits are returning. At the national level, the U.S. is once again borrowing heavily from abroad, and at the household level, we seem to be going back to over-consuming. Sales of SUVs are picking up again, too, after falling both in absolute terms and as a share of the total market during the recession. Gasoline use is also picking up after falling in earlier years because of the price spike of 2004 to 2006, followed by the recession of 2008 to 2009. Another problem, the production side of the economy is lagging far behind the consumption side, meaning that we're consuming, again, more than we produce. Industrial production is up, but nowhere near as much as retail sales, and you could say the same about capital spending, business expenditures on building and equipment, the motor of long-term economic dynamism. The default state of the U.S. economy looks to be profligacy. I don't want to conclude from this that the American masses need a round of austerity. They've got enough problems as it is, but all the deep structural problems of our economy and society remain unacknowledged and unaddressed despite this bone-crunching economic crisis. Okay, let's take a musical break, and we'll be back to talk about Europe. That was some of Haydn's String Quartet No. 62, a second movement performed by the Kodály Quartet, from their marvelous version of the complete Haydn quartets. It might be more familiar as Deutschland über alles. My first guest today is Lukas Zeise, a Frankfurt-based columnist for the German edition of the Financial Times. A lot of Americans, particularly those on the left of the political spectrum, view Europe as a far more humane way of doing capitalism than the American approach. There's some truth to this, but the position overlooks the fact that European Economic Union and the creation of the single currency, the euro, have been an entirely neoliberal project. That is, the project is driven by competition, fiscal austerity, deregulation, and the free movement of capital. The European Central Bank is far more austere than our own Central Reserve. Our Fed is under what's called a dual mandate. Its enabling law requires it to pursue both full employment and price stability. It was madly austere during the Volcker days of the early 1980s, but it hasn't been that way ever since, though if you listen to the nation's William Grider, you'd think it still is. Right now, the Fed is doing everything it can to stimulate our economy. Of course, the institution is deeply secretive, and its interests are skewed towards its prime constituents on Wall Street, but what they've been doing lately is still better than nothing. The Fed's European counterpart, however, has only a single mandate, price stability, which makes it far more an agent of austerity than our central bank. But it's not just central banking. Germany in particular has been taking a very hard line on the countries in debt crisis right now, like Ireland and Greece, and maybe someday soon Spain. For a view on why Germany is taking such a hard line, I turn to Lucas Seisa. Welcome, Lucas Seisa. Let me just start with the central question here. Why is Germany taking such a hard line with the crisis in the European periphery?
The answer is quite simple to my mind, because they've always taken a hard line, and that's the way they feel they're on the safe side. Are taking a hard line against their own population, and so they take it also with the European Union.
Why such a hard line? Is there a material interest, ideological interest? What is the inspiration for this constant passion for austerity?
Honestly, maybe I've lived here too long, so I think it's a natural state of affairs that, you know, a government of a capitalist nation, they just tend to do everything to keep wages low and social expenditure low and that kind of thing, in order to be more profitable and to keep taxes low for the capitalists. So that's the way it's been going along all the while. While they like to have a big common market with a common currency, they don't want to pay for that.
If Europe has a leader, it would be Germany. And doesn't a leader have to be somewhat willing to spend some money in order to stimulate things?
Can someone
lead? If you can't avoid it at all, then they will do it. Then they spend some money, but they don't like doing it. I mean, they just aren't willing to pay. They used to a bit, you know, but now they think, you know, it's worked very well. They are on top of the world just now. Capital is moving into Germany because Germany seems such a safe place at present. And so interest rates are low. Everything works out well if they just follow that hard line. At present, things go very, very nicely.
Germany spent a lot of money reconstructing the East. Did that experience have any effect on thinking in Germany?
Well, spending money, yes, they bought up the East. They bought up the country. I mean, they spent a lot of money in order to have a nice, good home market, and they now have that home market. There was no chance of doing it any other way, you know, as fast as that, and that's why I think that explains it a bit. It was a very special situation.
In your view, can the debtor countries get out of this crisis without any kind of concession on debt?
I don't think so. I'm also a bit surprised how very restrictive the German government is in this matter. And I thought they might be slightly more willing to let them off the hook. But in fact, now I think it's too late, to really get it going. So I think there's no way out that Greece and Ireland, I think they will just have to give up and declare default, I think. I think that's probably the only way out, really.
Now, some German officials have suggested that bondholders are going to have to take a hit in restructuring the debts. The markets did not receive that very well, but does that reflect current thinking in the German leadership?
Well, they say that, but I think they mean something totally different. Angela Merkel, you know, she says in 2013, they then should be prepared to, in future, restructure debt or take part in the restructuring of the debt. But that means that those bonds being sold in 2013, you know, they'll be sold at a very high interest rate. So it really means that you don't get at the private creditors at present until that date. So they'll be fine. They'll just sit and get paid by the governments in trouble.
Do Germans worry at all that this austere approach to the debt crisis will only result in a deflationary spiral that will drag the whole continent down?
Yeah, at present there's no fear at all, because just at this moment the economy is running quite nicely. So there's more money around than there used to be, than there was a year ago, quite a lot more. So there's no sense of deflation at all. But there's a sense that, well, things are going quite well. The fear is only there in political circles. You know.
What fear in political circles? Why?
The old Chancellor Schmidt, you know, very old man, over 90, I think now, he says the handling of this crisis is disgusting. I mean, it's terrible, because the Eurozone will break up. And of course that fear is there, but people on the street, they don't feel that. It's just things in foreign countries that are a bit disturbing, that's all.
The German economy does seem to be doing better than most in the world. What is driving it? Why is Germany doing better than everyone else?
Well, because it's very strong in exports, and it's very strong in exports in machinery to China or Asia and Latin America. That all goes very well, and it also still goes very well in the Eurozone. So it's an export-driven recovery.
And it doesn't worry about losing export markets in Spain or Greece or any of the other countries in trouble?
Yes, maybe there's a bit of worry. But then if you don't sell very well to Spain and Greece, then, well, maybe they'll sell a bit more to Brazil and China. That kind of seems the attitude they're taking at present.
Over the last decade or so, German workers have become quite more productive, but wages have been under great restraint. Is there any political strain as a result of this?
Less than last year. You know, last year things were not very well, but now it appears that strategy of the German government has really come out very well. You know, people are fairly happy, unemployment is going down, and then, you know, the very profitable companies are saying, well, maybe we'll pay a bit more wages, and that goes down very well, and so people are fairly content. There's less discontent than a year ago, much less.
Is Germany's luck going to hold out? Do you think this strategy will continue to work, or are things likely to come flying apart?
I think it's not going to work. It can't continue for very long, but maybe another year, maybe. But I doubt it.
What do you see happening?
Well, I see happening that world trade isn't growing or isn't rebounding as it had been. So the export-driven recovery will drizzle out. I don't think it'll continue like that. Things will then return to stagnation or something like that. You know, it won't continue boom like it feels like here at present.
Would Germany be happy to see maybe some of the peripheral countries just drop out of the euro? And
I don't think they'd really be happy. I don't think, not even the government would be happy. I don't think the German industrialists would tolerate it. They would force the government to do something about it. So in the end, they'll be probably much too late, but they'll do a lot of things in order to keep them in the currency union. Maybe not Greece, but certainly Spain.
Is there any significant conflict between German industrial and financial interests, or they see pretty much eye to eye?
I think there's a conflict, but as yet it's been solved as it is. I mean, the conflict goes along that line that, of course, the financial interests are to, you know, be really restrictive, while the industrialists care a lot about this big European market with the currency that is very profitable arrangement for them. So they are adamant they want to keep that market.
So if it really looked like Ireland or Spain or even Italy were on the verge of default, do you think German industrial interests would press the government to be a little more indulgent?
I'm surprised how little they do it up to now and how little they really put pressure on the government. But when in May, when the Greek thing really exploded, then Frau Merkel hesitated and said no. And in the end, she said, well, let's put some money up for Greece, you know. In the end, they did it.
And will Spain be able to stay out of a serious crisis, or do you think Spain is going to follow in the footsteps of Greece and Ireland?
I think it'll in the end also be hit, but I don't know how fast that process goes. I'm surprised how long the banks in Spain have been holding out, but I suppose they have a lot of good income from Latin America. I think they really have problems with their real estate market, and the banks are much too large in Spain.
Would the authorities be able to handle a Spanish crisis, or is Spain just too big to handle in the way they've been doing it so far?
Well, in the end, I think it is possible. Of course it is possible to handle the crisis, but I think they'll just mishandle it as they've mishandled the crisis before. That's why I'm really pessimistic that the whole arrangement will survive.
Which arrangement? The euro or?
The euro, yeah. The euro.
Does the whole project just have too many fundamental contradictions, yoking together countries at different levels of productivity with no overarching fiscal or political authority? Does the whole thing really make sense, or will it just fly apart because it really fundamentally doesn't make sense?
It is a misconstruction, I think. The currency union without any arrangement to get things harmonized works quite nicely when the economy is going fine, but now the economy isn't going fine anymore, so things tend to fall apart. Either you then start a really strong reform of that construction, and or the thing falls apart, and I think that's what it'll do.
You see the falling apart is more likely than this crisis leading to some sort of political evolution and creation of those structures that have not existed yet.
Yes, I think that is much more likely.
And what about any attempts to, for example, do some kind of Keynesian redistribution to the periphery in order to build them up in the hopes of strengthening the whole continent?
There are no politicians who want that. You know, there are no political parties who put that forward. The French government is a right-wing government and not really interested in doing that. And the German government couldn't think of doing it, to have a Keynesian program for the Eurozone or for Europe. They've just accepted it for Eastern Germany, but they would never, never do it for you, I think. Quite out of the question.
So if the euro does, if the whole project does fall apart, what do you see happening to the continent's political and economic structure?
That's a very difficult question because if it falls apart, then the result will be an economic crisis, but one that will affect the whole world, I think, because it's so bad. That is not unlikely now. No.
So this financial crisis, both on the European and more global angle, is far from over, in your view?
Yes. Still in the early stages, it seems to me.
That was Lukas Zeise, a Frankfurt-based columnist for the German edition of the Financial Times. You're listening to KPFA and KPFB in Berkeley, KFCF in Fresno, and the web to kpfa.org. My name is Doug Henwood, and the program is Behind the News. Back after a musical break to talk about the digital culture.
Axiom 5 for information workers who wish to stay alive. Supply never withhold the information requested, with total disregard for interests personal and vested. Chinese whispers is an analog game, where the signal degraded between brain and brain. Digital whispers is the same in reverse. The word we spread gets better, not worse. Better, not worse. X said to Y where they said to be. B wrote an email and sent it to me. I showed C and C wrote to A. Flaming World War III. Cut, paste, forward, copy, CC, go with the flow. Our ambition should be to love what we finally know. or if it proves unlovable, simply to go.
That was some of The Age of Information by Momus. My next guest is Jody Dean. She teaches political science at Hobart and William Smith Colleges in Geneva, New York, and is the author of 6 books, the latest of which is the terrific Blog Theory, published by Polity. It's a fascinating and sophisticated book, and a radio interview, even a longish one like what follows, can't do it justice. So if this topic interests you, what the digital revolution is doing to our minds, politics, and culture, please pick up a copy and read it. Jody Dean. Welcome, Jody Dean. Before we talk about communication, I just wanted to talk a bit about a blog post you had last month, Inept or Unwilling, the Left, Inept or Unwilling, how the new left delegitimized the old one, making political will into an offense. Could you talk a bit about what you're thinking of with that?
Yeah, thanks for asking about that. I was starting to wonder, why is it that there seems to be so much criticism of the Obama government, the Democratic Party, yet at the same time, so many leftists don't seem to be able to do anything but whine about that, the fact that we're not doing anything. So there's a strange combination of lots of real criticism, very smart critiques about the Obama administration's close relationship with Wall Street, criticism of the Obama administration for failing to take up the torture enacted by the Bush regime, and yet we don't do anything. Now, lots of leftists are not idiots. People know how power works. They have all sorts of analyses of class relations. They have analyses of media. So I started to wonder, well, is it the case that leftists are just somehow totally inept, lack the knowledge and skills that the right or even the Tea Party has demonstrated in the last 2 years, or is there something else? And I started to think, maybe because I wanted to protect leftists from this possible accusation of basic stupidity, I started to think, you know, it's really more that we're unwilling. And this unwillingness, I think, has been associated with an unwillingness to speak for other people, that's considered wrong, that it's an unwillingness to try to claim power because any exercise of power is ostensibly wrong, that there's an unwillingness to speak as a left because somehow that's going to necessarily basically require a return to Stalin. And so I started thinking that really the problem on the left is not so much an ineptitude, an inability to know, say, how to send media signals or how to organize campaigns or how to organize people, but an unwillingness to do this.
And is there anything to be done about it, or are we just stuck in this situation?
I'm starting to think that actually more is being done, and I think this for a few reasons. Maybe this is just hopeless optimism, so I'm willing to concede that, but I'm starting to feel more and more that leftists are seeing the need for a more united front rather than relying on a kind of fragmented affiliation of multiple affinity groups. I mean, one of my friends recently said that, multiple affinity groups, that seems like the slogan of defeat. And so what I think that we can start to see is now more and more outrage about the big Wall Street bonuses and the failures of, the concession of the Obama Democrats to the Bush tax cuts for billionaires, I think that we might be starting to see more people starting to galvanize in favor of a more unified political approach. Now, I think it's still nascent. It's hard to say. I mean, it's not like folks are going to form a new Communist Party, and I don't think it's likely that the current Communist Party is going to be terribly useful. But I think that when there's at least a beginning awareness that more unity is going to be useful, that we'll see perhaps some new formations come about. I mean, that's a little vague, but I think it's possible.
There are many times I think of Karl Krauss's remark about psychoanalysis, that it's the disease of which purports to be the cure. But this business about networks, to some degree, might be one of those instances. You write a bit about this in the book as well. What about this obsession with networks and networks of networks?
Yeah, you know, it seems like around the if we look at the history of the internet and political appropriation of the internet on the part of the left, it has been presented and loved as the left as a kind of political salvation. So around in the 80s, you get all this kind of left libertarian idea of this free interchanges, free kinds of communication, free kinds of organization that will always be non-hierarchical, egalitarian, freely chosen, and mobile. And that was supposed to enable a kind of wonderful new form of political engagement. And then in the 90s, this gets taken up by Al Gore and the reinventing government and the possibility of town halls for millions. Then we get the dot-com crash, where it starts, where you know, we wake up and are thinking, hey, gee, this really was a great big finance game. This was a venture capital game. What happened to the political aspirations? Now, in the Dutch new media scene, there was a lot of talk about hacktivism, a lot of talk about tactical media, and again, the idea of being able to use networks as an alternative form of organization that would get out of the hierarchies of the old models of the party and enable quick, rapid response, quick, rapid, diffuse responses. But the thing is when everything is quick and rapid, there's no duration, and there's no need to try to build a unified organization. And there's actually no need for anybody to do much more than sit around in their pajamas and click all day. So the networks that were supposed to be so empowering actually participate in dissipating people's political energies. Let me give another example. I remember for a while people were talking a lot about portal sites and organizing sites and hubs and all this. Well, I started trying to look for left political organizing sites, and they're tens and 20,000s of these. They're probably more organizational sites than there are actual kind of organizations. And this makes it then really difficult to try to use new media as itself the vehicle for organization. It doesn't, for left politics, new media is only one means. And unfortunately, I think it has been introduced as too much of a single means. I'm going to add one more thing. I know I'm talking long on this answer, but there's something that in contemporary media that's really personalizing. So each person starts a blog. Each person does a podcast. Each person registers her opinion or forwards or starts a petition. This individualizing push of contemporary media works against building left collective movements, and it works against the formation of collective ideas or mutual ideas. It becomes instead the mutuality loses in favor of each particular individual.
You write about how some of the core beliefs of the hippie movement then kind of became appropriated by communicative capitalism. Stuart Brand, a very crucial figure in that. Could you talk about how this notion of decentering authority and everyone, this hyper-individualism, this hippie cyber-politics?
Yeah, sure. This comes to, that part of blog theory draws from really exciting work by Fred Turner. And what Fred Turner has done in his study of Stuart Brand is show that there are different moments in the kind of California, Silicon Valley computer culture. And one aspect of it was very political and very active in the egalitarian and left political movements of the late 60s and early 70s. But another side of it was very was much more libertarian and much more entrepreneurial. And this is the side associated with Stuart Brand. And what's so odd about this libertarian strand of the kind of Silicon Valley, you know, in this Silicon Valley political moment, is that they accepted completely ideas that were promulgated and furthered by the Rand Corporation. And this isn't like a conspiracy theory kind of idea. Really, it's more like they accepted some really fundamental suppositions that they then thought were critical of sort of big companies and the military-industrial complex. For example, the kind of communitarian computer people thought that work should be done in moving egalitarian work projects rather than in hierarchically bureaucratic structured projects. Well, the thing is that the space program, the advanced developments in defense also use this idea. They also worked on a project basis across different divisions and not in a big hierarchical structure. So to claim a kind of networky, egalitarian structure as itself a challenge to corporate power or itself a challenge to military hierarchy was actually wrong. The Rand Corporation was already doing this. Additionally, the kind of communitarian computer people, cyber communitarian people, took a great faith that technology will solve our problems. Well, that was also the view of the military-industrial people, the Rand Corporation. They also thought that technology would be the vehicle to, you know, to peace, to order, to solving all sorts of problems. So at least in these two instances, ideas that became a kind of major component of the hippie-esque, libertarian-esque approach to computers associated with Stuart Brand and the Whole Earth Catalog, and then the Well, actually had origins in the military-industrial complex and the Rand Corporation, and so they weren't particularly radical. They were just the same ideas in a different setting.
I'm speaking with Jody Dean, who's a professor of political science at Hobart and William Smith Colleges in upstate New York, and author of the book Blog Theory, which is just out from Polity. Well, as I was reading that passage, I was thinking of Hayek and the theory that markets are about information, prices are signals, and that's a kind of a decentralized planning mechanism as opposed to a Soviet-style central planning mechanism. And you know, these sorts of Hayekian Austrian economics analyses are always rather indifferent to the fact that these competitive markets always create very large concentrations of economic and political power.
Yeah, I'm glad you. I've been thinking about the Hayek stuff too, and the way that, you know, just maddeningly, it seems like there are tendencies in the left to kind of accept that kind of argument, so that local is always good, even though that's not a direct implication of Hayek. But they tend to make the idea that local is always good because local is counter to big organizations or planning. That planning is always wrong because planning is impossible. But what the planning is impossible idea leads us to is a kind of total precariousness in the workplace, a total precariousness where, like, companies refuse to hire their workers back because they're not sure. Then people won't. Then no one knows whether or not they should get more education or that they should move or whatever. Whatever kind of planning that one would think of as necessary for a large organization is rendered suspect, if not impossible. The thing that the Hayek problem overlooks is that these properties of networks, right, where complex networks actually tend to make hubs just naturally. And I think that, and if there's not an intervention to stop the hub, or if there's not an intervention to stop the concentration of wealth, or to stop the concentration of power, then it will keep going. And of course, that's not a concern of Hayek's. It's just more like this: planning is wrong, centralized planning is impossible because local knowledge is always superior. What kills me also is the way that these days internets are useful in distributing knowledge, but one doesn't have to accept the kind of Hayeking, we have to rely on prices and can't, you know, planning is impossible. In fact, you can use a lot of local knowledge and coordinate them if you have, you know, a kind of structure that wants to coordinate them and that's willing to coordinate them and bring them together rather than just letting them persist as tiny local, you know, islands or something.
Speaking of islands, you do use the word blogopelago rather than blogosphere. Why is that?
Yeah, I like blogopelago. Garrett Levink and I came up with that, though I think Dana Boyd may have used it someplace else. I don't want to take too much credit, I think we found that afterwards, but she may have said it first. But anyway, we started using the term blogopelago because blogosphere makes it seem almost like mass media, and it makes it seem like all blogs read each other and talk to each other, and that there's one conversation going on in blogs, which is pretty ludicrous considering there are hundreds of millions of blogs in multiple languages. Some only exist for a few weeks. Some have existed for over 10 years. Most Most blogs don't talk to most other blogs, right? Instead, there's tiny little concentrations. And then a few, you know, super blogs, super hubs. But the vast majority are very small with very localized concerns.
Let's see. I want to see if we can do this for the radio version, but it's a very important concept that takes many pages of a book to get over. But see if we can do it in a few minutes on the audio version. The notion of the collapse of symbolic efficiency and what kind of subjectivity the blogosphere and related technologies create. Talk about that collapse.
Okay, so there are sort of two ideas that are related, and that has to do with the collapse of symbolic efficiency and then with subjectivity. And I'll focus on the collapse of subjectivity first. The collapse of symbolic efficiency first. First, we shouldn't think about what is symbolic efficiency. Well, a symbol is efficient if it can be used sensibly in different contexts. So if, like Santa Claus. Santa Claus in the United States is a pretty efficient symbol in that I would guess probably 99.9% of the people who live in this country will recognize the fat man in the red suit and the white beard as Santa Claus. That's no big mystery. Now, of course, if we were in, you know, another country 20 years ago, Santa Claus may not be as efficient. And some of the Christmas symbols, let's say, you know, the Dutch Black Peter figure, doesn't have as much symbolic efficiency in the United States. People don't really recognize it. The thesis of the decline of symbolic efficiency comes from Slavoj Žižek, and the idea is that under contemporary conditions, and we'll call these conditions ones of kind of globalized media streams that are multiple streams, going rapidly around the world, circulating multiple ideas into multiple contexts, that rather than that creating like a great big single ocean, it remains in multiple teeny tiny streams or teeny tiny rivulets, so that what carries weight or what has symbolic efficiency in one context has no symbolic efficiency in another context. So, you know, people who are attuned to pop culture and internet culture might understand jokes about lolcats, but I think my father, who's in his 70s and lives in Texas and never is on the internet, does not know about lolcats and would not get them and wouldn't find them particularly funny, wouldn't really know what to do with them. So something like lolcats has currency only in a small area, right? It lacks symbolic efficiency. Now, the reason that this becomes important today is that we have lost some of the organizing identities that have been really politically useful. So things like to claim identity, to claim one's position as a worker, or to claim an identity as an African-American woman, or to claim one's sexual identity tends to these days now be immediately contested and made more complex and fragmented so that people will rightly point out, well, these things mean multiple things in different places. And that's true. But the effect of that is that the identity that one might want to claim, you know, in a political setting is no longer efficient. It doesn't carry weight. It can't make things happen in its name. The same thing could be like the roles of, let's say, intellectuals. The right has been really effective in criticizing, you know, pointy-headed academics, liberal intellectuals, all that kind of, and all that kind of like, that they associate with an East Coast liberal elite. Intellectualism now has a very strange status. On the one hand, it's highly criticized. On the other hand, it's not, people aren't clear what it means. On the other hand, it's difficult to speak in that as an intellectual. You know, it doesn't carry a kind of weight that it might have in the 50s. Now, that's neither good nor bad, right? I mean, it's just a kind of fact of the contemporary media political setting, which makes organizing really difficult, which makes forming a large movement really difficult, because the signifiers, the symbols, the things that mean something to everyone are difficult to pull together. You know, one of the weird and kind of interesting things about 9/11 truth is no matter what you think about the movement, it did have an effect troubling the administration's monopoly on the explanation for the 9/11 events. And so it started to make the symbolic efficiency of that event diminish or decline.
But it does try to substitute a notion that a very small cabal of people plan everything very successfully.
Yes, that's right. So that would be, that's generally a pretty negative thing. I mean, in terms of the kind of politics that I admire, I don't think that that's a terribly useful idea. But I think that the negative part of what they accomplished was pretty useful in that it helped break out, it helped diminish the Bush regime's authority around that event and the Republican evocation of that event.
I want to go back to this. You were talking about the identity categories a little earlier. Those identity categories had enormous influence in the 90s. They've receded considerably in the zeros and beyond. Why do you think that is?
Okay, so I think that there are two related answers. I think that on the one hand, there's this decline of symbolic efficiency argument, that that these identities became sort of naturalized, that people started thinking that they had to refer to specific actual people rather than to kind of positions. And once they became naturalized, then it was easy to always say, well, you know, people are different just because someone is a lesbian doesn't mean that she can't be a successful doctor. In fact, you know, my doctor's a lesbian and she's very, very successful. And so it became difficult to start to make political claims because people would always point to these very singular, naturalized experiences. So that's one thing. There's the kind of over-empiricization of the categories. But I actually think there's a kind of better material reason, and that is by the 2000s, it was becoming remarkably clear that neoliberalism had ushered in an extreme form of inequality. And that extreme form of inequality was actually, as I see it, enabling class identity, not necessarily with relation to where one stands in terms of owning the means of production, but in terms of one's economic opportunity and ability to use and acquire wealth, that was becoming clearer and clearer. And so that the class divisions that had been kind of pushed aside during the age of 90s identity politics were starting to come to the fore. And so that it's becoming increasingly available in the United States now an ability to argue in terms of wealth and in terms of being left out, in terms of being one of the rest of us who are not the millionaires. This is still not, it's not yet terribly well articulated in terms of class identities, but I think we're moving there, particularly with this, you know, these doggone Bush cuts that are extended for under the Obama administration.
Well, the right has been actually rather successful about using a certain kind of class language.
Yeah, they've been really good at using it to attack intellectuals and academics. They've been really successful in using it to attack scientific knowledge or expert knowledge. They have been really useful at using it as a kind of populist mobilizer, so that any people who tend to speak in the name of large-scale groups, let's say in the name of working people, are the speakers are criticized as elitist and as disconnected, and then the right-wing pundits are able to then kind of retake those positions as somehow more authentically theirs. I mean, of course, Sarah Palin is the best example of that.
But then there's an analog on the left of a certain distrust of experts and a belief that we are our own experts, a distrust of centralized authority, and it's sort of what we were talking about at the beginning of this. It's not just the right that's doing that.
Yeah, that's right. I shouldn't just say that it's on the right. I think that this is a fairly general phenomenon. I think the right has been effective doing it at a mass level. The left is effective at doing it at itself. And so kind of perpetually disintegrating its own possibility for moving into a better organized form of a movement.
I'm speaking with Jody Dean, who's a professor of political science at Hobart and William Smith Colleges in upstate New York, and author of the book Blog Theory, which is just out from Polity. I got a Facebook request the other day from someone who wanted me to like an entity that said, I think we can find 250,000 people who like Julian Assange. How do we do politics in this kind of environment where you know, we think that just clicking a like button is actually a political act?
I think this is the real question. And I was in London last week, and I felt like the answer is we do it by making sure we still go into the streets. So liking Assange isn't quite enough if they're not people in the streets. Or, I mean, this maybe I shouldn't say this, but I'll say it anyway. I actually admired the hackers doing the denial of service attacks. I thought that that was an effective way to try to fight in the name of or on behalf of Julian Assange and WikiLeaks. But I think that that's still a negative kind of battle. One can use, of course, the new media for organizing or for maybe a little bit of issue awareness, but until there's movement onto the streets, until there's organized movement onto the streets, until there's an organized establishment of, okay, we actually do have a program that should work, that we want to work, that we want to fight for, we're going to be limited to this kind of perpetual pointing and clicking and circulating, which is the recipe for political inefficacy and the continued triumph of this horrific form of financial despotism.
They got a lot of people out in the streets in London, and still the government passed the tuition increases. We had millions of people around the world in the streets against the invasion of Iraq, and Iraq was invaded. The French have been protesting pension cuts, and yet the pension cuts went through. Can just getting out in the streets, is that some sort of actually an equivalent of pressing a like button if there's no sustained organization to give it any punch?
Is the equivalent. I don't know if I want to say it's the equivalent, right? The reason I know, I think it's a step further. So it's not all the way, but it's a step further. And the reason I think it's a step further is actually because it takes more commitment. And that extra bit of commitment invests people more, not only in the outcome, but in working and struggling together. And so I think to that extent, I think there is more to being on the streets than just liking something on Facebook. But it's not enough. I mean, you're completely right. We've lost every big demonstration in terms of, you know, the war in Iraq. There was no response. All Blair and Bush said was stuff like, oh, well, you know, they have their right, aren't they? Isn't that good that they get to express their opinions and, you know, that's what we're fighting for? I mean, a totally maddening co-optation of the message. It's not going to be enough, but it's definitely more. It's definitely more, but there has to be a much more organized next step.
Is that kind of a demonstration at least a possible antidote to the whatever world you write about?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, on this whatever world, you know, in the book, it's a gloss on a concept from Giorgio Agamben called whatever being. And Agamben has a very kind of interesting philosophical account of this whatever being as a kind of contemporary subjectivity that's denoted simply by a capacity to belong, but not by anything it belongs to. And I take this philosophical idea and kind of, you know, bring it into the gutter or into the streets by just saying, oh, well, whatever, and turning it into more of a marker, not of a kind of political possibility, but towards a kind of absence of political possibility where folks are in a position where they just sort of like, oh, gee, you know, well, there are bailouts for billionaires and the people on Wall Street are getting record bonuses, whatever, what's on TV or, you know, what's on YouTube. And so I'm extremely critical of this sense that somehow being post-ideological or post-race or post-class or post any identifiable marker is a political advance. I think it's absolutely the opposite, that a mentality where people say whatever is the one that lets essentially the bad guys who are willing to give billions to make sure that the health insurance industry remains intact, that the big banks remained intact. They love it when the rest of us would say whatever, right? That means that they get to keep marching on without a fight. And that's at least the thing that stuff in the streets do, is it says we will fight back. mean, that's not, again, that's not enough. But I think it's a nice confrontation with this, or even refutation of whatever being.
And to what degree does the structure of the new media contribute to this whatever subjectivity? For example, the blog is short. The most recent thing is always at the top. You write about this. It's a world of linking and displacement, but not sustained narrative or analysis. Is this creating a kind of subjectivity that really cannot think and organize in any meaningful political way?
That's been the primary tendency, right? The way that blogging and all of these kind of natively digital applications are working are toward encouraging us to express a kind of immediate sense of what we think and where we are. So what are we doing right now? So I can write a little blog about the fact that my Christmas tree fell off the car, and then I can tweet, oh no, tree off the car, and then I can put a picture of the tree in the road on Facebook, and like four friends like it, and this is now some kind of, this is now my media day. But that kind of mediality substitutes flat, thin relations for a kind of longer, more sustained ones, and it substitutes a reflection on the setting one's in and what to do about it for a really immediate kind of engagement. And this is—it's like today. It seems like mediality has become immediate, so that nothing is really mediated in a strong sense. We just live in this constant media world of immediacy. But the thing is that I am a blogger, right? You started out the show talking about one of my blog posts, and I don't think that blogs have to be that way or are necessarily that way, but I think the overall media environment we inhabit pushes our media consumption and media practice in this whatever brief, flat direction. And let me add one more dimension to this, right? That's not simply about the kind of short character responses or triviality of responses, but something actually I think even a little more fundamental and even worse. In the history of so-called Western philosophy, the idea of reflection has been associated with what it is to be a free person, right? Free people are supposed to reflect on our world, our situation. We're supposed to be able to reflect and then criticize it, then maybe deliberate about it, and then come to some kinds of decisions or agreements about it. But reflection has been crucial to a critical spirit. One of the things that happens in this contemporary bloggy world or contemporary mediated world is that reflection becomes another kind of capture. Why? Because I reflect on, let's say, just for example, I'll reflect on something on my blog. Somebody else will reflect on what I've said on theirs. The next person reflects on the next thing. And then it becomes just a circuit. And so by the time, say, 10 bloggers have reflected on it, blogger number one then adds her 2 cents about what everybody else said. And you can just keep circling and circling around without ever moving to any kind of point of action or decision. The same thing happens on the mainstream media, right, where the talking heads just talk about each other constantly, and where then there's some kind of and then they talk about the event of themselves talking about each other. The blogosphere doesn't provide a vehicle or a way out of that. It actually, It extends that kind of talking head, pundit, reflective logic out into more and more people so that we end up all, or everybody who's highly mediated, end up all doing the same kind of thing. And that becomes yet another barrier then to actually getting out, acting, and organizing movements and, you know, maybe even other parties with duration.
And finally, whenever I talk this way, I worry that I'm just sounding like an old fart going on about the kids today. Should one embrace that feeling, or is there a way to get beyond it?
Yeah, that's a good question. My ideas are kind of conflicted here. The one thing is I think about is, again, the kids on the street last week in London and who've been out on the streets in Greece, in Ireland, and Italy in the last weeks and months. I don't think that they are old farts. I don't think that they would disagree with this analysis either. That's why I think that they're in the streets. Is I think that they, I mean, that's not the only reason, obviously, but I think that there's an implicit acknowledgement that you have to be out there fighting and struggling for a better world against, you know, these austerity measures and against this giveaway to the rapacious financial sector. And so that they're actually, that it's not an old left view. It's like the new view under late neoliberalism that says, my God, you know, we have to fight. So what's interesting is that it's actually not kind of like, you know people nostalgic for a late 60s kind of activism, but rather new people, right? New people who aren't nostalgic at all, but are seeing their whole world being taken away. So that's the way I try to get around this, because actually it's only other people my age who ever accuse me of being an old fart, so I decide not to worry about that.
Late neoliberalism, that's a nice bit of optimism to end that. That was Jody Dean. Dean teaches political science at Hobart and William Smith College in Geneva, New York, and is the author of 6 books, the latest of which is The Terrific Blog Theory, published by Polity. That's it for me, Doug Henwood. Let's go out with this, a bit of the song Gold by the Sicilian math rock band Uzeda from their 2006 album Stella. I love Uzeda, but I will admit that I also wanted to say Sicilian math rock. Till next week, bye.